The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2017 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2017. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
All right, good morning. I think we're finally ready to go. Thank you for your patience. Okay. My name is Karen Moore, and this session is titled Latin Literature, A Garden of Delight, because that is what Latin truly is, just delight all around. This workshop is focused on your logic or a rhetoric stage of Latin classes. And I'm assuming at this point in time for most of what we're going to do today that your students are reading pretty well and that they've completed most, if not all, of their Latin grammatical studies. So we've learned of all the verb tenses and the noun declensions, and we're reading in the subjunctive and all of that kind of thing because we're getting to a place where we can read authentic Latin literature. Now, even if your students aren't there yet, that's okay. There is some of this that you can definitely bring down into lower grades. And I think it's also so very important that even the youngest grammar school teacher, starting in third grade, has a vision for where you're going in your program. That's so very important. But I just want to be clear up front, before anybody panics or runs out of the room or anything like that, about kind of where we are in that program. So let's open with a word of prayer, and then we'll get started. Lord, I thank you so much for this weekend, for this opportunity to meet with like-minded educators, to hone our craft, to share ideas. I pray that you please bless each person here, that you bless this time together, and that in this talk you would use me as an instrument to share ideas, to bless, to inspire, to help, to aid. I pray that you would bless each one here and give them a fantastic weekend, that we would go out encouraged and excited to continue the good work you've put before us in the fall. In the name of Jesus Christ, we pray. Amen. Okay, I have a bad leg, so I'm standing here precariously. I won't fall, I promise, but just kind of want to explain that. So let me start with this. One of the reasons why I call this talk A Garden of Delight is because that's a phrase I've often heard some of my fellow colleagues use in education. That yes, it's rigorous, and yes, it's hard work, but we really want to create this sense of a garden of delight. In a garden, you have to weed, you have to pull, you have to dig up rocks. It is work. But there are also around us beautiful sights, fragrant aromas, good fruit to eat that should be a taste and a blessing. So that makes that rigor all the worth it. Another image I like to talk about is as a mountainside. You hike up a mountain, and that is not easy work. But along the way, hopefully you're seeing things, taking in things that are a delight to you. And when you get to the top and arrive up there at the summit, you can look past, look back behind you where you came from. You can look around you and really take in the scenery with a deeper appreciation for the climb that you've just made. And I really believe that's what this kind of education should be. Yes, it is rigorous, and yes, there are parts that are challenging, and we're going to have challenging courses that read challenging things and do challenging things. But I hope it's always something that is engaging the students, that it is delighting their minds, that is encouraging them in their growth. And so that's really what I hope you take away from this talk today. I think Latin is a particularly wonderful class poised for this kind of adventure that I've just described. Because in my mind, Latin is the ultimate interdisciplinary subject. When I started taking Latin in seventh grade, because my mother forced me to do so, it was a public school, I won't go into the whole story, but I was somehow tricked into taking Latin. But I fell in love with it very quickly, not just because of the beauty of the language, but because of the history I was able to read. I was fascinated by history. As I grew up into the high school program, fantastic teacher who brought the literature to life for us. Latin poetry is some of my favorite literature across all genres, all time periods, because it's just so beautiful and so rich, and it still amazes me what these men and women did in the craft, the way they crafted words. So I really believe that in studying Latin, especially when you get to this reading level, Latin really does have something for every student to enjoy, even if they're not the grammar nerd, okay? So there is history. There are passionate orations. I mean, I've read wonderful pieces where Cicero or Queen Elizabeth are telling somebody off in Latin. It just doesn't get any better than that. Beautiful poems, as I said before, with incredible imagery. Scientific treatises. We're going to talk about one of those today. Theological and philosophical queries. Just the capture of history across the ages. And I'm not talking just about the classical era. I'm talking from the earliest centuries BC all the way down to the 18th century. So there's really, truly something for everyone. So the first thing I would say you should do as you're crafting this class is to consider the students in your classroom. Because at the base foundational thing, the whole point of your class is to read good works, to read excellent literature, to hone their reading skills. But there are so many different pieces before you that you can do that with. And if you find some good pieces that relate to them well, in which they're interested in, that relate to other things they're studying, it is much more easy to engage them in that work and to make them feel the joy of that delight. You know, if you have a student who, some of my students, for example, love Caesar and the Gallic Wars and they find that interesting. Some students, they really don't want to read one single more line of Caesar. Poetry, I could say the same thing. But what I love to do in my Latin literature classes is to provide a buffet table, in a sense, where we read different things, different pieces, different styles, so that along the way, along the journey, they're exposed to some wonderful things, but they also discover some different topics, different readings that really resonate well with them and their interests and their studies. So that would be kind of my introduction. So let me talk a little bit about what a Latin literature class looks like. As I said at the beginning, in our school at Grace Academy, students study Latin grammar third grade through eighth grade. By the sixth grade, they're reading some adapted pieces. By eighth grade, they're reading unadapted pieces. By the end of eighth grade, they have learned all of their grammar. So when they come into the School of Rhetoric in ninth grade, they're ready for a true reading course. Now, we still stop and review because it's funny how they don't retain every single thing you teach them. So we do stop and review along the way, but the course is centered around readings. In fact, I like to call it a humanities course, a literature course that happens to be in Latin. So let me ask you, this is audience participation time, what do you expect to see in a literature class? English, humanities. Poems, okay, what else? The great texts, okay. What kind of things do you do with those readings? Okay, connect it to the Bible, history. Good, talk about plot development, character development, themes, yes. Good, engage the test, asking questions, so some reading comprehension, discussions, style, literary devices, maybe some composition, right? Typically we like to read and we like to imitate excellent writing. That's kind of the whole point of reading the great text. Read excellent literature so we, A, know what's excellent, and B, know how to better write in a more excellent way. All of these same things I like to put into my Latin literature classes. So I like to think about all those same type of things. Okay. Now how I frame this course. In some ways, it's like what a literature class would do. Typically, the students are assigned a book, such as The Great Gatsby, for example. And you don't read it all in one night. You pace it out, and they have to read a certain number of chapters or a certain number of pages. And then the teacher would give an assignment. Could be preparation for a class discussion. Could be reading comprehension questions. Could be forming that lovely plot cycle, narrative structure. Could be an essay on an assigned topic. Could be some other type of a project, but something that, as you all said, engages with the text. So I do something similar as well. Now, unlike an English literature class, I don't have them read an entire book like The Great Gatsby, because we do read a lot slower in Latin, and that's okay. So what I like to do is pull sections of books, of works, that do relate to other things that they're studying. As you mentioned, we want to connect it to history, to Bible. And oftentimes, I would venture to guess that your English literature classes line up with your English history classes. Am I right? Reading something of the same period, okay? And that you draw connections wherever you see them. I like to do the same thing. I actually go to teachers and who are of the same class, same grade level, excuse me, and find out what books they're reading, what they're studying in history, what conversations they're having in science. And I've used those discussions to begin to frame the readings I put forth to my students. Because, A, this is kind of one of our tenets of classical education, right? To look at things all as a whole and not parse them out into subjects. B, if they're studying World War II, or if they're studying the period of the Magna Carta, they're going to be more naturally interested in me putting out Latin before them that relates to those things. Oh, yeah, we're studying this here. And they begin to see the connections of Latin, that it's not just a course in an old dead language, but it's really a course in world knowledge, because Latin was the vehicle for so many years, and it can really connect well to so many things. So before I get into specific assignment, specific texts, I'm going to kind of give you a framework of the type of assignments that I give and the way I structure my class. So we typically have, in our school year, it's divided into four quarters in the high school. I know some people do semesters instead, but I always kind of want to look at where that end point is going to be so that I plan my path well out for that quarter. And I'm going to look and see what texts do I think, and as I said before, I don't do a whole work. I don't read all of Caesar's Gallic Wars. Oh my gosh, that would just take forever. And I'd rather read poetry anyway. Sorry, Caesar, but I like poetry. So I plan out what snippets I'm going to do, what sections, and I try to choose things, as I said earlier, I'll talk about this more, that are meaningful to other things the students are studying or that I know they're interested in. The first thing I do when I hand them a passage of reading and I assign them a text, for example, one of the pieces we're going to look at is the story of Pyramus and Thisbe from Ovid's Metamorphoses. So I'll give them section one. It's okay, we're going to start with this section one of this poem. The first thing I want you to do is create an unfamiliar vocabulary list. One of the challenging things about the course I'm going to propose to you is that we're changing authors and changing styles, which is good in that they're seeing a wide range of exposure, which is a challenge in that the vocabulary will shift around a lot. And sometimes they feel a little bit frustrated that I don't know every word. Say, it's okay. I bet I could throw you about a dozen English words you don't know either. In fact, side note, I often make this point to them. My dear ones, when you just finished reading Othello or King Lear from Shakespeare, did you know every single word immediately? Did you have to look any up? Well, yes. But you're a native English speaker. Don't you know English? And I explained to them, when you're reading Ovid or Virgil, you're reading basically the Shakespeare level of Latin. So take a breath and relax. It's okay. Anyway, side note. So I'll have them make a list of the words that they don't immediately recognize, and they need to look those up. And I have them do that because then whatever assignment we're doing, whether it's reading, writing, or spoken, and I do all three in my class, they have that word bank right there, and we don't have to stop and wait for everybody to thumb through their dictionary to find a word. Secondly, this was something my high school Latin teacher did, and what I found over the years is that it really helped me to learn words better. You could be the human resource, but please don't. Because if they have to go through the labor of looking up a word, especially if they have to look up that same word five different times, they will learn it better than if you just are the automated word teller and give them words every time. So have them go through that. Sometimes what I do is I give an unfamiliar open note vocab quiz the following day, and that's really just to keep them honest, to make sure that they're doing that. And I'll tell them it's open note, so you can use the vocabulary list that you made, but I'm going to semi-randomly pick 10 to 15 to 20 words, put them on the board, and you have 5 minutes to tell me what they mean. I do that because human nature, as you know, if there's not going to be a grade, then I could shove it off. I tell them do everything as unto the Lord and as if it were for a grade in my class. So they make that list, and then I'll give them words. Now, I'm intentionally picking words that are common, important Latin words that I think they really need to know. I'm not trying to find the one obscure thing, right? So sometimes there are words that, and I do kind of a range of easy, medium, hard, too. And I don't put words on there that they're going to, you know, some dictionaries, you have to look up something as part of idiomatic expression. It refers you to three different places. No, I'm just trying to really give a vocab check. And everybody's list will be different. So it's not like I can just hand out a vocab test. Second thing that we sometimes do, and I'm going to give you one of two patterns. So pattern A, unfamiliar vocab list, and then a rough translation. I'll expect them to do a certain number of lines. They can work in groups of two or three to have that brainstorming session. I'm always present so that I can answer questions and I can help coach. I typically answer a question with a question because I want them to think through it. I don't get this sentence. It doesn't make sense. My darling, it makes perfect sense. You just lack the understanding. But that is why I am here to help you, I say with a great big smile, and they roll their eyes. That's okay. It's a loving role. It's not a disrespectful role because it's kind of our ongoing joke. So then I might ask them a question. Okay, well, let's start with the verb. Where is the verb? Because especially with poetry, the word order throws them, and they need to kind of go back to the basics. Vince Lombardi, here's a football. Where's your verb? So I'll ask them questions. Okay, now what's the subject? What case do you think this could be? What do you remember seeing from yesterday? So things like that. So they go through a rough translation. Then step three would be an oral reading and discussion. Now, when I hold these oral readings and discussions, I make them put their translation away. I will not allow them to have it out. They can have their unfamiliar vocab list out. Those are the training wheels I allow them to create the first day, but not their English. Now, this does cause a little bit of panic up front, but I also give everybody permission to make mistakes, including myself. So we are all fallible. We all make mistakes. We're all learning. If you didn't make mistakes, you wouldn't need to be here and I would be out of a job. So we can all make mistakes. What I found, and this is something that my Latin teacher required of us too, and what I found when I went off to college was that there were a lot of students who had come into class and they were just reading what they had written and they didn't really know the Latin well. Some teachers feel like, well, they can just memorize the whole passage. Well, memorization of a passage will only get you so far. I don't know anybody who's going to memorize 1,000 lines of Virgil or Ovid unless they've got some incredible photographic memory. So I would encourage you to put the English aside, help them again, read through, think through the Latin. Sometimes I flip that process. Okay, so that's pattern A, vocab to rough draft translation to oral discussion, and then I let them do a final copy where they go back to their English and they fix it. They make it a little bit better based on, they can take notes, by the way, on their unfamiliar vocab list. If you wrote a word down wrong, go ahead and fix it. If you didn't recognize a verb tense, go ahead and make that note to yourself, but you can't take dictation. Okay. So pattern B, I flip it. Unfamiliar vocab list first, and then we go right into what I call sight reading, which means they have not prepared a translation in advance. Don't do that on the first day of class. Unless you give them something really easy, then it's okay. But I let them build up to this. And this is another great skill. It's coming at the language a different way. And I think they're pleasantly surprised at how much they have learned to do and how much or how well they have learned to read, especially as the year progresses and they can see how they read at the end of the year in the spring much more easily, much more fluidly than they did in the fall. After we've done an oral reading discussion, sometimes I go back and ask them to turn in a written copy. Sometimes I just move into some sort of a reading comprehension assignment from there, and I don't require them to produce a written copy. That's just totally up to you and where you are and what you want to accomplish with that piece. So assessing the reading, and I'm using the word assessing intentionally as opposed to testing, because I think we get locked into this idea of the test. There are many ways to assess a student's reading ability, to assess their understanding of a passage. One way is to do a reading quiz. where I bring them or put before them roughly five lines of a passage. Now, obviously, dactylic hexameter poetry, five lines, is a lot shorter than like Caesar's Gallic War, five lines, or at most prose, five lines. So you can decide what the length should be, but something relatively short that they can do in about 15 minutes. I'm not looking for it to be a full class test, just a reading quiz. And I'll put that before them. If there's an archaic word in there or something that's, you know, very rare in Latin, I might give them that. But for the most part, since they've done unfamiliar vocabulary, plus rough translation, plus reading discussion on this passage already, they should have the vocab down for the most part. So a reading quiz would be one where I give them a few lines and say, you have 15, 20 minutes. Please give me a literal translation. I ask for a literal one for two reasons. The most important is because if it's literal, even if it sounds awkward, I can better assess they understand how the Latin is working together. Latin expresses things in a different way than English does. Therefore, if you're doing a literal translation, it might sound a little bit awkward in English. That's okay. I want to make sure you're understanding that this verb is indicating future or future perfect or past. I want you to understand the relationship between this adjective's modifying this noun, not this one, or it's an adverb, not an, those kind of things. So that's what I'm looking for. Two, while I don't teach to a test, I'm very well aware that some of these students are going to take an AP Latin exam at some point, and that's how the AP Latin exam will require them to do translation, is as literal as possible, for the very same reason. They want to make sure they're understanding the grammar, the vocabulary, the Latin language, and not that the student just knows the story super well, recognizes that scene, and can retell it pretty well, if that makes sense. So I'm prepping them knowing that that's going to be something they may choose to do. Another way to assess is reading comprehension questions. We do a lot of these orally. In the book that I'm going to reference here, The Latin Alive Reader, I often follow passages with an extensive Responde Latine section with Latin questions that you can use either in a classroom dialogue orally or you could make written. I also often like to put together about a short five-question, short-answer reading comprehension assessment where some of the questions will be asking about the plot, the character. How does Virgil portray Queen Dido in this particular scene? Give me some adjectives that support what you're saying. So it might be partially Latin, partially English in that kind of a response. Or what advice does the king give to his son in this passage? Cite the Latin that supports your answer, because I'm wanting them to not just remember the story, but to be able to connect that to the text. Or if it's poetry, one of the questions could be to ask them to scan a line or to comment on what rhetorical device do you see in line 5? How does the author use that in this passage? I really want to get more at what does this word, this sentence mean? I want to start getting more at what is the design and intent of the author in writing this way, and how does he accomplish his goal? How is he portraying this character? How is he developing this theme? And how does his word arrangement or his word choice support that? Okay. I, of course, do at times the standard test, right? Grades are a fact of life, and we do need to have an assessment. So I like to do those short assessments. I also like to do tests, probably one or two per quarter, that will include a wide variety of those things, right? So some translation, some exploration of the text, the context, the goal of the author, some questions, Latin, English, combination of both, okay? One of my favorite things to do, however, is to think of a larger project that engages the students in an interdisciplinary mindset, perhaps through art, perhaps through composition, and we're going to look at some of that in these sample lesson plans coming up. So before I get to these sample lesson plans, I want to just reiterate what I said at the beginning, that I form these lessons by looking around to see what the students are learning, what they're engaged in, what their interests are. For example, I'll do this one as an example, then we'll go and look at these. In eighth grade, so this is just before we get into our Latin lit reading, The students are looking at the medieval era in their history humanities class, in their literature class. So we read selections from the Magna Carta in Latin class. And we have a fun little exercise where I then put them in groups, and they have to create their own clauses that they want to demand of their own Prince John, a.k.a. our head of school. And so we have him come in, and Dr. Diener's our head of school. He's such a great sport. He puts on a robe and a crown, and we go through our court etiquette. It's our own made-up court etiquette. It's nothing official. But they have to do it orally. So they write it out. They think about it. They plan it. But then they have to come before the king, curtsy, bow, present their request in Latin, but then translate it for him because he doesn't know Latin. We're working on that. He knows Spanish fluently, but not Latin, so we're working on that. And then he always has some wonderful phrase to tell them, you know, very diplomatic about how, well, we'll consider it, and we'll, our people will call your people type of thing. But that's just one example of a fun way to engage the students in the Latin and reading something connected to what they've been learning, something of interest, and to engage in a different way where we're not just reading a text, but we're interacting with a text. And we can do that by not just reading and talking in English, but we can even do get some oral Latin in there as well. Okay, so my apologies. I don't know how well you're going to be able to read this from there. If you need to scoot up, feel free to scoot up. I have it up here. But the first lesson I wanted to go into is poetry. I love poetry. So this poem right here is the one I want to show you. And I'm kind of showing you the layout of the types of things that we have that I do to kind of supplement this poem. So this is from Catullus. And his book of poems opens up with a dedicatory poem to his patron. And he starts out with this phrase, Qui dono lepidum novum labellum, to whom do I dedicate this new little book? And so we read this fun poem, and I love Catullus. I love some poems of Catullus. Some poems of Catullus, no. I like some of his poetry for the humor he's able to infuse into it. This one and the one that he writes to Fabulus about the dinner invitation are ones that cause the students to snicker and smile. I'm like, see, Latin's funny. It's not all dry. Some of it's funny. So we read this one. They enjoy the humor of the dedicatory poem. But then I get into less, oh, by the way, over here, here's kind of an example of my Responde Latine section where I ask them questions, and I like to do it orally. I prefer to do it orally, but every now and then, for the sake of time or whatever, we sometimes do them written. But then I like to explore the meter of Catullus. He writes in a hendecasyllabic meter. I'm not going to go into the lesson meter with you right now, but in essence, the nutshell version is there are 11 syllables per line. Now, true to Latin form, those of you who are familiar with dactylic hexameter, there's a combination of things like the coriam and iams and different things that make up those 11 syllables. But for the sake of concision, it's 11 syllables. Thus, the Greek word hen, deca, 11, syllabic. Okay? So I teach them how to scan this. We look at the rhythm. Hen, deca, syllabic is pretty easy to scan. And then I like to show them, you know, Catullus inspired more modern poets, such as Alfred Lord Tennyson. Alfred Lord Tennyson is a huge fan of Catullus. There are many poems that he writes that mimic Catullus's theme, his style, different aspects. One of them is actually titled Hendecasyllabic. I'm going to go to the next page because you can see it better now. So in the hendecasyllabic, Alfred Lord Tennyson is mimicking the exact meter of Catullus. Now, it's a little bit different because English meter is formed differently than Latin meter. Latin meter, those of you who studied know, it's the long and the short syllables. So learning all those macrons and diphthongs all those years becomes really important. With English, it's more stressed versus unstressed. So Tennyson is going with the stressed versus unstressed, but he's following the exact same pattern. And every line does have 11 syllables. So we talk about that difference. They get a little lesson in scanning English poetry versus scanning Latin poetry. They see how Tennyson knew who Catullus was able to read Latin and Catullus, liked it so much that he imitated it. So I'm helping them bridge this gap in the thought of Latin as being old and not used to seeing it in a modern context. But as you read through this, you can see that not only does he mimic the style, but he begins to talk about Catullus. All composed in a meter of Catullus, all in quantity, talking about the syllable lengths, careful of my motion. I like this, like the skater on the ice that hardly bears him, lest I fall unawares before the people, walking laughter and indolent reviewers. We also talk about this. See, he uses this phrase, indolent reviewers, several times here, down in here as well. And I said, that's because he already knows that line fits the meter. Also, we talk about literary devices such as anaphora, where you begin a phrase with a certain, you repeatedly begin a line or a segment with a certain phrase. So they said, well, that's kind of cheating. It's artistic cheating. And yes, the poets do that often. And then when they get to Virgil, I start to point out things in Virgil where he repeats some lines. Well, he knows that line already fits that meter, and it fits the situation, so it works very well. So we read through this. We talk about different themes here in Catullus, the references that Tennyson is making, the lines, the syllable length. I like to go from here to a little composition project. Now, at this point in time, they're ninth grade. They've just been exposed to the concept of meter in poetry in Latin, how it's like and different to meter in poetry in English, and the idea of stress versus unstressed, long versus short, and those patterns is a little bit overwhelming. So I intentionally choose with a poem that requires a syllabic length, but doesn't have to deal with longs and shorts and stressed and unstressed. So I actually go to the Latin haiku. Okay. Now, again, this is my ninth grade class. They're actually doing modern history. At this point, they had been studying World War II. And as part of that, some Japanese culture. So this integrated very nicely. The haiku is a Japanese poem. The theme often relates to nature. And I'm going to come back to how that plays into it later. Now, the great haikus, I understand, we're up to 100 stanzas in length. I just required 3 because we have other things to study that year. But each stanza consists of 3 lines, a 5-syllable line, a 7-syllable line, and then a 5-syllable line again. And this is very doable for them. And it's really helping, again, to kind of cement that understanding of the syllabic length and the syllabic patterns that are in these types of poetry. So this one, Arbores Altai, the tall trees, Fraxinus ilex quercus, this is an ash, a holly, an oak, Kaisai, having been cut down, nunc absunt, now they are absent. So very short poem focused on nature. This actually dovetailed, and I'll talk about it more in my last or next to last project, with a botany unit that they were studying in their biology class in the spring. And so we did some things in Latin class to support botanical terms and terminology. And so asking them to write a poem that was in the haiku, the Japanese style, connected a little bit to their history, literature studies, asking them to do one that focused on nature, and they had to use some of the botanical terms they were looking at, supported biology. And it really engaged them in a new way. We spent a few times, by the way, going outside to look for inspiration. We have a beautiful 35-acre campus. I love having class outside under the oak trees, just reading poetry together. Okay, art study. This is another favorite. Now, my mother is an artist. My sister is an artist. My cousin is an artist. I'm surrounded by art. I do not produce it well myself, but they do, and I have a great love and appreciation for it. So much art is based on Latin literature. The 12th century was called the Aetas Ovidiana, the age, the Ovidian age, because so many great masterpieces were produced based on Ovid's Metamorphosis. So here we read the study of Pyramus and Thisbe. I read this in ninth grade, and by the way, the very first book they read in literature class in ninth grade is Romeo and Juliet. So we get to have some wonderful connections, and that's one of the reasons why I chose this myth as opposed to perhaps some others. There are tons you could choose from. So we read the entire story, and then I like to pull art pieces and tell them, now, when this gentleman created this painting, he knew Latin. He read that Latin poem. There are things that he is trying to represent from the Latin poem. So let's look at that and pull those things out. So questions I always ask are things like, where are we in the story? What scene is this? What has happened thus far? Okay, obviously this is the death scene. Pyramus is already dead. Thisbe's about to be dead. There's a creepy little statue watching. What scenery here is described by Ovid? The lighting here is not that great. So I don't know if you can see it, but there is the mulberry tree. Now, one of the things I ask them to do is don't just tell me in English, tell me in Latin too, and even tell me what line you're citing, because I'm really wanting them to interact with the text, right? So there's a mulberry tree. Arbor is used. There's a fountain. This little statue is actually on top of an ornate fountain down here. There's a fountain. Gelidu contemina fonti. There's the line. Thisbe's tattered cloak. They see that down here. He's lying on it. Interestingly enough, it's red. So the cloak almost looks like a pool of blood, too. It's very, really cool. What elements are different than perhaps what Ovid may have described, and why? Perhaps the artist took some artistic license. Let's talk about that. The clothing is not entirely Greco-Roman, but has been influenced by fashion and time period. On the statue is a small little Cupid. And there's no mention of a statue in Ovid, but as we talked about it, they thought, well, but the Cupid really does look as though he's looking at them. And the fountain is referenced so often and is even spoken to, addressed at one point, that it's almost as if the fountain is acting like a witness. So perhaps this little statue is to try to communicate that idea of the pure fountain witnessing this tragic event. How does the author use color? So I get into some art pieces too. How does the author use lighting? Always introduce or conclude discussion with the author of the painting, the time period, and the location of the work. Because what I'm trying to do here are two things. One, I'm wanting to reinforce the Latin reading by giving them something visual to connect with, not just typed words on a page. Two, I'm sneaking in some art appreciation and some art history as well. This piece is an oil on canvas. It actually is in Florence, Italy, was painted, or the author was 1558 to 1605, and is now on display in the Uffizi Gallery. Another reason I chose this particular piece is because their senior year, they do go to Italy, they do visit the Uffizi Gallery, and I would love for them to see a painting. They go, oh, I remember reading that story in Latin class. I remember looking at that. So if you do a trip like that, that's something, again, to consider that you can kind of bring and weave into their learning along the way. I'm going to show you this page right here, and I'm going to give you this blog site at the end. This is my blog site. I like to post some of these projects and descriptions of them there. I know you can't read this. It's too small, but I just kind of wanted to show you. This is the top part is what I just showed you. The bottom part is a second painting I gave them of the same scene by a different artist. Same type of questions, and we compared and contrasted how these two different artists both interpreted the same piece of Latin. Okay? Then I followed this up with their own art project. As I said, there is more than one way to demonstrate that you understand a passage. Some students are excellent at composition. Some are excellent at translation. Some really enjoy art. So one of the pieces that I did was to tell them, okay, we have looked at a couple of paintings. I want you to go back, and I want you to look at the story of Pyramus and Thisbe in Latin, and I want you to pick a scene, and I want you to interpret it artistically. And I'm not looking to see that you are the best artist ever. I'm looking to see how well you interpret the Latin. So you have to be able to show me, explain to me, and in some cases, I'll even have them write a short paragraph synopsis that uses the Latin. How are you interpreting it? This was one of my favorite pieces. It was not perhaps the most artistically excellent, because we tend to think realism when we go for that. She went for more an abstract, but it was a really cool abstract piece because she pulled this line right here straight out of Ovid's A Metamorphosis, line 71, Saepe ubi constiterant hinc Thisbe Pyramus illinc. Often where they had sat, here, Thisbe, Pyramus there. We talked a lot about this line because Ovid uses this wonderful chiastic phrasing. Here, Thisbe, A, ABBA. That's right, sorry. Because we have our demonstratives here on either side, and we have our people here in the middle, right? So here, Thisbe, Pyramus there. And it's almost as if you can just see there's the wall, and they're juxtaposed up against each other. So she did the same thing here. Here's the wall. She has them juxtaposed. She quoted his line, but she changed Saipe often to Semper always. Now, as I said, I sometimes ask them, and in this case I did, to give me a very short write-up, a very short paragraph that explains to me how they're interpreting the Latin, and they have to be citing Latin using it. What her point was is she put them in silhouette here to show that after they had died, their spirits forever, always, Semper, sat against that wall. I was like, oh, that's a really cool interpretation. And you really did think about the Latin as you're putting that in there. So again, that's another way I like to engage students. Not everybody likes the art project. Some of them loathe it because they just don't like to draw. But that's okay. They need to experience it. And for my students who are very visual and love art, this is a garden of delight for them. Okay, another one, De Bello Gallico. I'm going to juxtapose Caesar with Columbus, which might be an interesting thought. So right here I have the very first opening of the Gallic Wars, where Caesar is describing the region of Gaul, right? So Gallia est omnis divisa in partes tres. It's one of those lines that if somebody's taken Latin in the past, they can always recite to me. Gaul is divided into three parts. And I won't read through the whole thing, but he goes into describing where those parts are, who lives there, the rivers, the mountains. It's a lesson in geography. So one thing I really like to do is I like to pull in a map. And after we've translated this, they put away their Latin. We bring out a map. And I give them swords or pointers or something. And I will, it's a gigantic map that takes a huge table, and it's all in Latin. And I read Caesar, and I ask them to point and show to me where we are on the map. And that's a wonderful exercise, again, to engage them visually in that map activity. Another one that we read in ninth grade is Columbus. And again, here you can see the setup where I have Columbus broken up into sections. Here's a pars prima, here's a pars seconda. I have notes and I have responde latine questions in between. I'm going to highlight this particular section. Now, Columbus, once he had discovered the New World, he wrote back to King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella, and he wrote in Spanish. But because they wanted the whole world to know about this wonderful discovery by the Kingdom of Spain, they published it in Latin. And so it's now called the Latin Letter of Columbus. We do not read the whole thing because it is fairly long, but I like to pull in a few passages. This is one of them in which he's describing, He's describing this island, Dicta Insula Johanna, the island called Johanna. And he talks about how there are septem vel octo palmarum genera, seven or eight kinds of palm trees. It talks about their height, their beauty, all kinds of herbs. He talks about sunt et mirabiles pinus agri et prata vatissimas, vere aves, various birds, varia mela, various honeys, and various metals, except iron. Pine trees, fields, meadows, very, very vast, right? He goes in to talk about maximi sunt montes et pulcri, beautiful tall mountains, vasta rura, vast countrysides, numera groves, most fertile fields. So he's just really nice visual description of this terrain. So we kind of have two explorers here in a sense, if you will. Caesar describing the terrain of Gaul, Columbus describing the terrain of these islands off the Americas. And so you kind of have a interesting juxtaposition of passages that are centuries apart. Slightly different motives maybe, but in both cases they're wanting the folks back home to know what they're exploring or conquering, and you can have that conversation too. So after we've read these two, I like to take them outside to our campus, and we are blessed to be on a 35-acre campus. We'll go outside with a Latin dictionary and a notepad, and they have a couple of days to write just a short paragraph describing our campus. And so I want you to think about the ways in which each one of these authors wrote their descriptions. Columbus was more simple and straightforward. He used a lot of asyndeton, just listing things. Caesar was a bit more, I guess, Eye of the Eagle type thing, where he's talking more about regions and mountains and rivers and how they divide this enormous landmass. And I said, you can do either one, but draw from some of those and describe our campus. This also dovetails nicely if you're doing any kind of science studies, because you can get animal names, you can get plant names involved, and I like to draw those exercises in. In fact, in some of my younger classes, I will even do zoology exercises where I'm giving them the scientific names of animals and having them match them to the common names. And that's kind of a neat way for them to see how their Latin is connecting to science. In fact, I've had some students begin it by, Grace Academy is divided into three parts, and they'll divide it and talk about the division and talk about the wild natives who run around the playground and all sorts of things. So that's a lot of fun. And so again, I'm getting them engaged in the text in a different way. Botanical Garden Project. So this year did something really fun with our biology teacher. They were having this botanical unit, and I wanted to integrate the studies with the class. So we put together a project where they had to go out for him, and they had to identify, I think it was 10 to 15 different native wildflowers. And I actually have one of the projects right here. My daughter was in the class. It was very easy for me to swipe this if you want to look at it. Very simple. They had to take a picture. They had to give the scientific name, the common name, where it was found, an interesting fact about their flower. So that supported their botany studies very well. We also talked a lot about botanical terms in Latin, so they had to do that for me. And then we actually went out and wanted to renovate. We had a butterfly garden that had been kind of neglected a bit, so we decided we were going to take on as a ninth grade class project the renovation, if you will, of this butterfly botanical garden. And so they had to involve that along with their Latin studies and along with their science studies. Now, at the same time this was going on, I was doing the haiku poem, and so they had to pull in the names of some of those flowers into their haikus, and some of them even put in papilla, which is a butterfly, and the apes, the bees, into that. So right here you can see the Allium stellatum is the Latin name, which literally means starred garlic. This is a wild onion. But if you look at the flowers, they really do look like little stars. And the Allium family does pertain to wild onions and garlic bulbs and those type of things, because they're a very similar plant. So future plans, this is the first time we did this. I thought next year I want to include on this project right here that they translate the name, the scientific name, and not just put it there. We talked about it, but to actually do that. And we'll keep seeing where it goes. But that was something they really, really enjoyed in the springtime. Here's actually a picture of the butterfly garden, because I just had to include a couple. The younger students love it, and you can see here some of the butterflies floating around. Okay, last one. This is the last one. And this one is Isaac Newton. So for my math kids, for my kids who want to become engineers and physicists and all that great stuff, I love including Newton's Principia. These are his three laws of motion, and he lays them out very nicely. I don't have a close-up of this one, my apologies. He starts each one out with a basic principle or a law, right? And then each one has a small paragraph that is expounding upon that law, giving what he calls a scolia, or an example. A lot of them have to do with, this particular one has to do with a trundling hoop. It's basically the idea that once an object in motion stays in motion, right, until something physically stops it. So he's using the example of what he calls a trochus in his Latin text, because he wrote it in Latin, because Newton was just that cool, and because that was the language he used at the time. So we point that out. He originally wrote this in Latin. You're reading his original work, not somebody's interpretation, the trochus. So we show them a picture, and this is a painting by Renoir. Again, I love to pull art in it, of a girl with a trundling hoop. We might call it a hula hoop, except that a hula hoop is very round, and these trundling hoops were flat because it meant to be a thin circle. And here you see a mosaic of a boy, and I'm trying to see what the date on that is. 6th century AD, of this boy with his trundling hoops, and that was the example he used. So then, as we read through this, I ask them, can you come up with some other examples that reinforce this principle that Isaac Newton was talking about? And I'll have them work with a partner to make up their own scolia to support Isaac's law of motion. And so, again, I've tried to do some different things, right? For my artistic types, I have the art and the paintings, the poetry. For my outdoorsmen, and I have quite a few of those in Texas, we have the outdoors, the gardening, the flowers. We do some things with animals. For my math guys and gals, I have not only, and Columbus really hints upon science in some point because you're talking about nature, right? But we have kind of a more mathematical approach with the Principia and the laws of motion. So these are a few of the lesson plans in my ninth grade class that I just want to share with you. I hope that they will inspire some ideas. The last thing I want to show you are some resources of some places you can go. TheLatinLibrary.com is a wonderful online resource. I believe it was put together and is run by Ad Fontes, a classical Christian school. If you go there, you can find texts from the classical era, from the medieval era, and what they call Neo-Latin. Now, Columbus and Newton are both considered Neo-Latin because they're past medieval, so they're kind of it's the new Latin, I guess. Now, a caveat, the texts of thelatinlibrary.com are not going to have notes or vocab lists or anything. It's just the raw text. So you're going to have to do a lot of supplementing with that. You can search online. Also, this book, and here's my shameless promotion, The Latin Alive Reader, Latin Literature from Cicero to Newton. This is one I put together based on the things I was doing in my classes. It has more in here than you need to do in a year, maybe two. But I did that intentionally because every class is different. Every teacher is different. Every group of students is different. And so some of these things, like I was showing you the pages up here, I have project suggestions in here, and I have notes and teacher helps in there. Another book that I really like that is focusing just on the classical era is called From Aeneas to Augustus. And if you want to Google that one, it's about this thick, has a ton of writings, both prose and poetry, of different levels of difficulty, and some really great fun pieces in there. And that one will focus on the classical era. And the other thing I wanted to share with you is my blog site. The poetry lessons are actually on my blog site. I believe the Columbus one is too. But I have a variety of lesson plans and ideas that I've done in my class from third grade on up through 12th grade. Also just some fun Latin stories where Latin pops up in the world around us. So please feel free to visit and totally steal whatever works for your class. Yes, ma'am. Sure. So the blog site is www.latinaliveonline, one word, latinaliveonline.com. So at this time, and I think I've lost my clock up here. Can anybody show me what time it is, please? 6 minutes after 12. Wow. So I did. It's, okay, I'm still within time. We have 4 minutes for questions. But it's lunch afterwards. We could just stay here all afternoon. Yes, sir. Oh, great. Mm-hmm. Okay. Oh, good. We did that once, too, I think with an Aesop, and we had them act it out, but they did it in Latin. So, yes, that's a lot of fun. I think any way you can get them up and get them moving and engaged in something, it just helps them learn better. My Latin teacher, my mentor, would always say, the more senses you use to learn something, the better you're going to retain it. So, yeah, fantastic. Thank you for sharing that. Anybody else? Questions, thoughts, ideas? Yes, ma'am. I would say you can actually use it alongside book three, but for most of what you're going to need or you're going to use, you need to use the subjunctive. So, for example, the Latin Alive book three we use in eighth grade. Well, that's at the same time as the medieval readings. And actually, I'll tell you a little bit of trivia. So Latin Alive book three was intentionally going to have both classical and medieval readings in it. But it was getting to be too long and too thick. So what they decided to do is to end it at this one particular point, which happened to be where the classical was ending, and they would use all the medieval for this reader, which we wanted to do. We were just thinking it would be a little bit later. So a lot of times I will bring things in like the Magna Carta into the eighth grade class who's using Latin Alive Book 3 because I want to supplement some medieval while they're doing medieval. By the way, as I'm thinking about it, another great thing to include in these as a supplement are the creeds. The Apostolic, the Nicene Creed, the Chalcedonian Creed, all of those were written in both Greek, published in both Greek and Latin. And especially once you get to gerunds and participles, you can easily do those, and it's pretty easy reading for them. So I love those because they feel like, wow, I can do this. Like, I got this one down. But it's also a really nice way to reinforce any kind of apologetic Bible study they're doing too. And especially in the medieval zone, they're doing a lot of church history and creeds and heresies and all that fun stuff. So, others? Yes, sir. Yes, I do. I do. In fact, in this book, there is a passage from, I think it's Luke 2, the birth of Christ. And then Matthew, I forget the chapter, but it's the resurrection. So those two are in here. And then I love to sprinkle in my 6th, 7th, 8th grade classes. I love to sprinkle in mottos and ancient proverbs. And I will do Vulgate quotes there too. Great question. Anybody else? Yes. Yes. You know what? A dear friend of mine found that at a garage sale. I'm sorry. Yes. And I have a picture of it on the blog site, and I'm kicking myself now that I didn't bring it. But, yeah. So I will go. You know what I should do is I should go. I will go back to that post next week, and I will amend it with the title and publisher. But I doubt it's in print anymore because it was just huge. Yeah. Things you can find at garage sales. Anybody else? Well, thank you so much for your time. I don't know about you, but my tummy is rumbling, so I'll let y'all get to lunch. Thank you.